Hi, I'm Juan Pablo Montoya, and you're listening to F1 Weekly.
There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, Stephen, and there you have it. There you go.
Hello, this is Desiree for F1Weekly.com. I'm your in-depth correspondent.
Let's go. With the qualifying, Steve.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Nasser Hamid, my co-host. This is podcast number 826, March 30th, 2020. Nasser.
Thank you, sir. I say welcome to the Solzhenitsyn era, days of isolation, and as you like to say, no ration. What else is new in the California gulag?
On today's program, Lando Norris shaves his head. Timmy Hill said he had to make the move. We have a new feature this week, and it starts with Gary Sloan on F1 Current Affairs. And our next interview blast from the past this week is none other than Johnny Herbert. And this was from podcast number 105 in 2006, I believe. And real quickly, I need to remind you folks that we need your contributions. Keep this program on the air. Just click on the Support F1 Weekly tab on the front page. Anyone who donates $100 or more will receive an F1 Weekly coffee cup and sticker. Nash, welcome to the studio. How are you?
I am doing good, sir. Thank you. We now have stay-at-home instructions from the man in Tampa, Florida also. What can you do but just watch motor racing on YouTube and Formula One website, which I must say I'm enjoying very much. How are things on the left coast?
The left coast is wonderful. We're getting a little bit of rain, a little bit of springtime weather. We are hunkering down, as they say, shelter in place at the Palatial Studios. But for me, I go to work every day, as most people.
Well, you know, the flights to California from Florida, you can fly on wonderful Spirit Airlines for less than $100. So I was going to show up at San Jose Airport sometime soon, but then I was talked out of traveling anytime soon, and now with this quarantine here, or whatever they want to call it, I'm back home in Tampa for a while, and we'll see how it works out. But I just hope this thing is over soon, so we can get back to life that is normal, whatever that means for, you know, different people. And what will happen to the 2020 season, sir, if there will be one? The opening round at this time, and correct me please if I'm wrong, is supposed to be the Canadian Grand Prix in June. The organizers are facing an April 12th deadline to make a decision, and the French Grand Prix is also set for June. The way things are going looks like the 2020 season may start where it all started back in 1950, Silverstone. There is already talk of 2020 season ending in 2021. Not a bad idea, but who can guarantee the start date? I think and very much hope the 2020 season starts this year, and if it rolls into 2021, maybe we can have 2 1-hour Grand Prix races, one for 2020 and one for the 2021 season. Your thoughts on rescheduling the calendar?
Well, I'm sort of leaning on Bernie's style, forgetting 2020 completely, but that's going to be hard to do, especially when the curve flattens out on the coronavirus and we all begin to go back to normal. We will need to have racing, and I think around June seems to be the promised land.
I hope so, but I have a feeling that it may drag on a little bit more. But I'm very confident that we will have some racing. Even if we start in November, I'm sure they can cram at least seven races this year and then carry forward some in January, February, March. So we will see how it works out. I will not be surprised if a few races become a permanent victim of this virus and never come back on the schedule. And talking of rescheduling, I'm sure you already know, back home again in Indiana won't be till August. So the Indy 500 has also been postponed, which is, of course, a smart decision. And Roger Penske has decreed that all the executives must take big pay cuts, but the show will go on once it can go on. Any sign of any sporting activities in California anytime soon?
Not that I know of. Everything seems to be getting canceled from Sears Point to Laguna Seca.
Yeah. Any more update on the Laguna Seca change of ownership?
No, the new management team is in charge. I guess they got dealt a crappy deck of cards with this coronavirus thing. But right now, all they have to do is put out press releases. But they seem to be managing quite well.
Okay, that's good. Now we come to new deal. As you know, several high-profile contracts are over at the end of the 2020 season. They include your favorite, Lewis Hamilton, everybody's favorite, Daniel Ricciardo, and Sebastian Vettel's favorite, Sebastian Vettel himself. I don't see Lewis going anywhere, as he likes to remind, Mercedes has been supporting him since his karting days, which is true, and all his race and championship wins have been powered by Mercedes. Why leave a winning combination and proven formula, I should say, for Helter Skelter at the Scuderia? You know, there have been rumors floating around that Toto Wolff will go to Aston Martin, you know, Racing Point, Aston Martin, because he did not attend an important meeting and he was seen with Lawrence Stroll. And whether that happens or not, I don't think Lewis Hamilton is leaving Mercedes. What say you?
Well, I have some news about Toto and Lance Stroll in my Gary Sloan segment, so I'll save it for then.
Okay, sir. Next, we come to Daniel Ricciardo. It is generally accepted in Formula One paddock that leaving Red Bull cost the Honey Badger some sweet success of race wins. It is also agreed upon that staying at Renault will most likely cost him any chance of world championship. I do not see him winning races and staying at Renault after the 2020 season. Personally, I don't think he will go back to Red Bull. He has seen that movie before. It was called Nightmare on Max Street. But Danny Boy will be a good mate to Charles Leclerc. He is not into office politics and does not bring, to borrow a phrase from Christian Horner, chaos into the team. Or to borrow a phrase from Sonny and Cher, a cowboy's work is never done. Andale, Alonso, your 2 pesos on this issue?
No, there's no issue there. I don't see an issue. It's going to be tough with Mercedes continuing to dominate, so I feel bad for any driver, Vettel, Ricciardo. But if you're not at Mercedes, you're not part of the trophy case party.
Very true. Next on the agenda, Sebastian Vettel. Since the arrival of Charles Leclerc in Maranello, Seb is no longer their commissar in town. Now reports are circulating from Italy that he is being offered only a 1-year extension, and on top of that, with a deep cut in salary, an effective strategy when you want to push somebody out the door. Given his performance against his new teammate last year, the number of mistakes in the past 2 years, and best excuse for management, the current economic conditions, I cannot see Seb taking a huge pay cut and get pounded again by Leclerc. Question is, where can he go? There is no open door at Red Bull. I can see him at McLaren being recruited by his fellow Deutschen man, Andreas Seidel. You know, I had a brief chat with Andreas at Abu Dhabi, and he said to me, I worked very hard to get the Mercedes deal. I think he can work hard again to mate a German driver with a German engine, even though the engine is made in England at Brixworth, with a big donkey to Ilmor. What say you?
Well, the interesting part is there's lots of talk of Vettel going to Renault next year. So you could be right. It could be Vettel to Renault, Ricciardo to Ferrari. All's well that ends well.
I personally don't think, I mean, anything can happen, but I personally don't think Sebastian will go to Renault. What is he going to do there? McLaren would be a better deal for him with a Mercedes engine, I think.
I think retirement and staying at home is going to be the best deal.
Yeah, that is a very good option available to him, especially if there is no seat at Ferrari or a high-paying job at McLaren, because he's not hurting for money, that's for sure. Okay, now we come to Fistful of Dollars. You always get some good news in bad times, because there are good people around in this world still. Red Bull owner Dietrich Mateschitz is the Sergio Leone of motor racing. While his private eye, Dr. Helmut Marko, lamented, if five races are canceled, $100 million will be lost by all the teams. Dietrich declared that all staff members at the Red Bull Ring will be paid in full during the corona pandemic. Nice to hear Vienna calling with very good news. You like that news item from Dietrich Mateschitz?
Oh, yeah. I thought it was great.
Yes, sir. It's good news, especially in this day and age. Okay, sir. And now we come to GB on JB. Gerhard Berger, the man who gave Benetton their first and last Grand Prix win and also won races for Ferrari and McLaren, is today the boss man at ITR, the organizers of DTM, the German Touring Car Championship. He was trying to get Jenson Button to race in the series this season. The 2009 world champion recently gave up on his Japanese Super GT ride with Honda, driving the NSX, because of constant crossing the pond, something he was not too keen on doing again since becoming a papito. According to Berger, Button was interested but declined the offer as he is now living and walking in LA. And who can blame him, Mr. Rogers? As we all know, it's a lot of fun when the sun comes up on the Santa Monica Boulevard. And you know, with this meltdown we're having because of coronavirus, you know, I have some concern about quite a few series, and one of them is DTM, because a few years ago, Mercedes left, and it left only two teams, BMW or BMW, as the natives call it, and Audi. And then Gerhard Berger, through his efforts, they brought in Aston Martin, but they have also now left the building. So we'll see how it works out. Anything else, sir, would you like to talk about?
Yes, so I'm going to read the latest from Gary Sloan. Of course, Gary Sloan is the author that wrote In the Pit Lane, F1 Exposed. F1 Exposed is a great book. It's available at inthepitlane.com. Inthepitlane.com. And here we go. This week's episode is called Toto's Jigsaw Puzzle. Back in 2014, Formula E founder Alejandro Agag approached Toto Wolff with the hope of signing up Mercedes for the series. Toto declined and pointed out in his opinion that Formula E wasn't different enough to attract fans. His other concern was the transfer of engineering knowledge to road cars. When we sell cars, we don't sell 10 engineers who sit with the driver. The early adopters switched to conscious of the environment, but if you want a big movement of people, you need to address the heart. Wind the clock forward to February 2018, and Toto proclaims, I didn't think it would survive the first 3 years, but Formula E is an exciting platform, and against all odds, Alejandro and his team have managed to build a series, which is interesting for many people. It clearly hits the zeitgeist. Corporate boardrooms are talking about it, and what he and his team have done is truly amazing. This is when events start getting interesting in what is maybe Toto's master plan. Later in 2018, one of the founding Formula E teams, Venturi Racing, owned in true F1 fashion by the Monegasque millionaire Gildor Pastor, appointed a new team principal and shareholder, stepped forward, one Mrs. Susie Wolff. I'm sure Susie was appointed on merit, but being married to one of the most powerful men in motorsports probably helped a great deal. And then in 2019, Venturi Racing announced its engine, cooling system, rear frame, rear suspension, dampers, software, onboard electronics, and wiring looms would all be purchased by, yes, none other than Mercedes. Simultaneously, Mercedes decided to join Formula E in 2020. stating Mercedes have entered the fray so that it can showcase that it is a leader in the emerging technology. So, is this Toto lining up for a takeover of the Formula E series? In his ambitious to be top dog in F1, don't materialize? Interestingly, Toto's been busy in his old hunting ground at Williams with Mercedes extending its engine deal for a further 5 years. Toto commented at the time, Williams is one of the iconic brands in Formula One, and we at Mercedes are proud to count them as part of our motorsports family. They have been through some tough times recently, but that has only served to demonstrate their resilience and strength of character as they battle back to where they belonged on the grid. I am certain that the outlook for independent teams is brighter under the financial regulations that will be introduced in 2021, and we are delighted to continue our partnership with Williams into that new era in our sport. Really, Toto? I wonder how long before he makes a play for Williams, maybe when Daimler-Benz pulls out of F1 and Sir Jim Ratcliffe with his deep pockets outbids him for the Mercedes F1 team. Again, Toto probably always working on his plan B. Then there's the thorny issue of Toto's old buddy, Mr. Lawrence Stroll, the new owner of Racing Point, aka Aston Martin. One of these two guys will eventually be crowned king, as I suspect both have very ambitious plans. Lawrence is moving at quite a pace, at greater financial resources than Toto, and the latest speculation is Toto becoming CEO of Aston Martin, something that he has denied. I don't think this is going to happen, as Toto, I suspect, wants to be his own man and is probably tiring of Daimler's interference in the Mercedes F1 team. I believe the offer did exist. It was an attempt by Lawrence to curtail Toto's plans now in the future. Want some proof? Well, given the perilous state of F1 finances, now we are in a crisis. How long before the vultures arrive at Williams? Will it be Wolf or Stroll who wins that prize? So there you go. Williams' title sponsor, Rocket, has also entered Formula E. And yes, you guessed again, having decided to partner with Venturi Racing for the next 3 years. Susie Wolf was previously at Williams driver, so she may have had Claire Williams' assistance with Rocket, or maybe Toto played hardball with both teams on the engine deal. Also, Toto is getting guidance on Formula E, not just from his wife, but a former employee, Nico Rosberg, who owns 0.2% of all of Formula E. Gary Sloan, thank you very much. He is the author of In the Pit Lane, F1 Exposed. Details are inthepitlane.com. Keep up the good work, Gary. I love your opinion. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with Motorsports Mondial and the interview from 2006 where me and Nasser talked to Johnny Herbert, the Schumacher teammate. We'll be back after this brief message.
And here's your F1Weekly.com Formula One trivia. As we know, Fernando Alonso won the 2006 F1 Championship in Brazil, crowning him as a back-to-back champion. He joined the ranks of Ascari, Fangio, Brabham, Prost, Senna, Schumacher, and Hakkinen as the only men to successfully defend their championship title. Two of those men mentioned had three or more consecutive titles. One was obviously Schumacher with five, and the other man had four. Who was he? I'll have the answer toward the end of the podcast.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now, as we spin the globe and go around the world with Motorsports Mondial and the king, the guru himself, Nasser Hamid.
Thank you, sir. Since there is no racing in near future, today we will look at some dramatic debuts in Formula One. But before that, we have to talk about Nando. His ex-boss, or I think he may still be doing some business for him, Flavio Briatore was recently interviewed on the official Formula One podcast, which is available on YouTube. And it's a very extended conversation, very interesting. And of course, there is this question, who let the dog out? According to Senor Briatore, he warned Fernando Alonso against going to McLaren in 2007 because he believed Lewis Hamilton was in the pocket of team boss Ron Dennis. Nando was aware of the reservations, but felt that his speed would be enough to overcome any potential politics. Remember the famous six-tenth? Briatore has no doubt that the two-time world champion from 2005 and 2006 can again succeed if he is given a top seat in 2021. According to, and I agree with him, according to Briatore, Alonso is a Rottweiler, 100%. The thing is, he may be a Rottweiler, but his teammate in 2007 was no Chihuahua. But I don't think Nando is coming back to Formula One anytime soon, especially with this Corona thing going on. You have any hope of him coming back, sir?
No, nobody's coming back, but it's interesting how Flavio is spilling the beans.
Yes, and that's what happens after parties go separate ways. Okay, sir, now we come to our feature of the day. Dramatic debuts. Throughout the history of Formula One, many drivers and teams have come on the scene on the Clint Eastwood program, Sudden Impact. We shall start with Lucky Punk, just the phrase no disrespect meant. Giancarlo Baghetti, of course Italian, he had quite a start to his Grand Prix career. Back in the days when there were non-championship races, he won the first two events he entered. Then came the real test, his Formula One championship debut in the 1966 French Grand Prix at Reims, the street circuit famous for its long straights. Dan Gurney and his Porsche had the race won as they started the final long sprint to the checkered flag. Baghetti and his Ferrari took full advantage of the slipstream and at the last moment pulled out a miracle, a feat not duplicated ever since. Amazingly, the driver who won his first three Formula One races never won again. A true one-hit wonder. Now we come to Ricardo Rodriguez. Monza 1961. Ricardo became the youngest F1 driver and amazingly qualified on the front row. He retired while running third. His brother Pedro would go on to become Mexico's first and so far the only Grand Prix winner. Now we come to driver number three, Commendatore Mario Andretti. He appears on this list twice. Such was the magic of Super Mario. He was Rookie of Year at Indy in his first appearance at the Brickyard and won the IndyCar Championship in same fashion, both in 1965. His F1 career also started at the top. The man from Nazareth, PA, put his Lotus on pole at Watkins Glen in 1968. Then comes Carlos Reutemann. He was Mario's teammate at Lotus in 1979, which was a complete disaster for the team. Reutemann also grabbed pole in his first F1 appearance on home soil, Argentina 1992. Lole, as he was called, never won his home Grand Prix but found success in neighboring Brazil three times. Next, Gilles Villeneuve, impressed by his speed during a Formula Atlantic race at Trois-Rivières in Canada, James Hunt told his McLaren boss Teddy Mayer to look at this crazy Canadian. And there he was on the grid for the 1977 British Grand Prix in a third McLaren, out-qualifying the team regular number two, Jochen Mass. By next race, Gilles was driving for Enzo. And sir, this race took place when I was in college, and I remember this event very well because there was such a uproar about some guy coming. Nobody had heard of him in the Formula One circle. I, of course, had never heard of Gilles Villeneuve, but it was quite a shock for some totally unknown to come and out-qualify team's number regular two. Very, very impressive. Now we come to man of the day, Johnny Herbert. Pretty boy Floyd broke his legs at Brands Hatch during a Formula 3000 race in 1988. But he was lifted into his Benetton at the 1989 season opener in Rio. And Johnny came good, finishing fourth in his first F1 race. Good to see him these days in F1 paddock as a TV pundit. And he is as friendly as he was when we first met him at Laguna Seca many years ago. Now we come to Jacques Villeneuve. He pulled a Mario and Reutemann, out-qualifying his experienced teammate Damon Hill to grab pole for his Grand Prix debut, which was in the Australian Grand Prix many moons ago. Now, sir, interesting. Drivers winning on debut with the new team. This may or may not have been their first Grand Prix win, but this was impressive to win on driving for a new team. Mario Andretti, 1971, South Africa. R. Nige, 1989, Rio de Janeiro. Kimi Raikkonen, 2007, Albert Park. Your man, your Dios, Fernando Alonso, 2010, Bahrain. All of the above were first outings for the driver, for these drivers with Ferrari. Back in 1977, season opener in Buenos Aires, Jody Scheckter gave Walter Wolff victory on debut of his team for the Canadian oilman. And let's not forget, Adrian Reynard has promised debut victory of his design for BAR or Bar in the hands of Jacques Villeneuve in Australia. We all know how that ended. Now we come to last man standing and going very, very far, hopefully, Max Verstappen. There are times when experienced drivers take half a season, I'm not taking any names, to find the brake pedal. Max took the first opportunity at Red Bull and grabbed both horns and his first win at Barcelona after the Silver Arrows shot each other down on the opening lap. Max displays Seb as the youngest Grand Prix winner at the ripe old age of 18. It may have been a lucky win, but he held off Kimi in a Ferrari, an impressive display of speed, calm and cool. What say you, sir? I'm sorry, I forgot to mention a very, very important first-time winner. Back in 2005, I had no idea what a podcast was, and a Clark Rogers from San Jose, California, started a podcast that is still going on strong, and he's number one with F1 Weekly. So congratulations, sir.
We have been going strong for 15 years, and we will continue. Corona or no Corona, outstanding motorsports mondial, and now we're going to go into this Johnny Herbert interview. It was a great interview. I remember we saw Johnny. We had to run after him. I had to catch my breath. But in the end, it was a lot of laughs because he's a pretty funny guy, as you see on television, from podcast 105. And I'm also allowing for some emails that we read from that time period. I thought we'd just go ahead and let that whole show roll with some quizzes and some trivia. So everybody enjoy this interview and the extra stuff, because really we have nothing else to do while we shelter in place, Nasser.
That is correct, sir. And hopefully, you know, this too shall pass. And then we will go to different racetracks and do some more interviews and be happy. And also, sir, I would like to take this opportunity to say hello to all our familiar members here, US, Canada, everywhere. And I just hope everybody is doing well and, you know, staying safe. All the best to everybody.
Now, an interview with Johnny Herbert.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. What brings you to Laguna Seca?
Withdrawal symptoms. I'm trying to see if there's anything for a bit of driving next year. So far it's looking okay, but we'll have to see if we can get the deal together.
Wow, so you're trying to get back into driving?
Yeah, I think so. Well, I think I've still got a few years left in the old body yet, and the LMS has always been a great series, and yeah, it'd be good to get some racing under my belt back in for 2007.
How did the 2006 season go with you and MF1? Was that a productive role for you?
Yeah, no, it was a different role for me. I was sort of mainly there just to be sort of the happy face of the team, and I think it worked very well. The original time when I joined in Hungary in 2006, and it's sort of actually, to be honest, it got better. We got the media more on our side. The performances got a lot better this year. We got into a point where we started 2007 with no chance of even getting into the second round of qualifying, and then we got better and stronger, and they started getting into the second round better, and a couple of times the races were very good. So at the end of the day, I think the performances have gone up. And I think it's in a good position for the future, obviously, with Spyker now.
That's true. What teams are you looking at to get a drive with?
Well, I'm looking at a couple of prototypes and a couple of GT1s as well, because I think there's some interest in the way that the both of those sides are going with competitiveness. And at the moment, it's looking good.
Any plans on getting involved in Formula One, maybe next season at all?
Yeah, maybe. Well, I spoke to Michael Moll from Spyker probably about 3-4 weeks ago. It was just before China. And just before I came here to Laguna, I got a message about giving them a call about trying to meet up in sometime in November. So at the moment, yes, there may be a chance. Got a few ideas.
Can I ask a question? Yeah.
Johnny, I remember, correct me if I'm wrong, you scored a point in your very first Grand Prix in Brazil.
Yeah.
And prior to that, you had a big accident. How was the recovery from that big accident and getting into Formula One? Can you tell us something about those days?
Well, the accident was in a Formula 3000, which is like GP2 now, and it was an accident at Brands Hatch. Unfortunately, there was this what I would class as a nutcase driver who took me off, and it basically just ripped off the whole front of the car, and my ankles got pretty badly damaged. And when I did my first race, I think that was in August 23rd or something like that, and then I did my first, I think, steps back and walking. I think at the early, it was over the latter point of November, early part of December. Then I drove a Formula One car for the first time in early part of December. The first race in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil was the end of February, I think it was, in those days. And I had to more or less be carried to the car and sort of slotted in. To finish fourth in my first Grand Prix was... I think it sort of shocked the whole of the establishment because it wasn't expected. Probably didn't expect it myself, to be honest, but I had the determination and drive to be able to do that. And the feet weren't in very good condition anyway, but I was fortunate that the track itself sort of suited the condition that I had. But it definitely helped, I think, save my career anyway.
Now, if I may ask this question, Peter Collins was in charge of Benetton when you came on board, right? I believe he hired you, and I think the relationship did not work out between him and Flavio. Can you tell us something about that?
Yeah, well, Flavio joined. Well, I know he was there in Rio, so I think he must have been sort of around the end of 88, I guess. So he was definitely there for 89. And of course, we know what Flavio's gone on to do since then. And of course, the characters were very different. Flavio had a relationship with the Benetton family, for a few years before that. And obviously, he had eyed a chance of getting into Formula One. And he came in with Benetton. Peter was there, yes. And I think the relationship probably started, probably, unfortunately for Peter, in a negative way, because I came in as a disabled driver almost. And I do remember having a meeting with Peter, with Flavio, and with the Benetton family, and they were just asking me, was I up to the job? So obviously they had realistically negative feelings about it, where Peter was always positive. And then as the year went on, sadly, it got worse for me because obviously the feet weren't in the right decision, but that probably helped hurt Peter's chances of obviously staying on, but obviously aided Flavio's chances of going into Benetton and running Benetton like he did.
Yeah. I remember reading at that time when Peter Collins left Benetton, an interview with Flavio saying one of the things he brought up was your case that Peter Collins had hired you when you were in crutches or in plaster or something like that. Yeah. How was your relationship with Flavio, if you had any?
Yeah, well, I didn't have really a relationship on the first time in 89, but then obviously in 95 we had that relationship again, and it probably didn't go very well just because of Michael being there. He was world champion from 94. We all know how Michael runs in a team. He always wants the team to be completely behind him, which is fine. But I always I had a problem with Flavio because the second race in Mexico, Argentina. Michael asked that I could have be allowed to use his data to sort of look at. And Flavio agreed with him and allowed that to happen, which I thought was wrong. If it was Flavio was always telling me it was a team effort, but that didn't seem a team way of doing things. So we probably didn't hit it off, shall we say? You know, Michael is Michael. I don't have a problem with Michael, but I did have a problem really with the way Flavio sort of went along with Michael, which I thought was wrong. So we didn't have that close relationship, though.
Now, you're saying Michael is Michael. How did you find him as a person? And in terms of a racing driver, we cannot question his success. is he really that committed and that, like, nobody like him?
Yeah, no, I don't think, no, I think, to be honest, if you probably ask the majority of people, I think he has more, there's more majority that like him than dislike him, for sure, from a fan point of view. And I think he has a lot of respect within Formula One. I think he's also lost a bit of respect because of certain things that he has done. Well, I know with Damon, maybe with Jacques and the parking he tried to do in Monaco this year. And it's something that it just tarnishes that reputation. But I think it doesn't tarnish it in a way that realistically sort of actually overshadows everything that he has been able to achieve. It's not my way of going racing, but then again, he's been seven times more successful than I ever was. So, you know, it was a very, very different way of going racing. It hadn't happened before. You know, we'd never seen it with Ayrton or Alain Prost or Jackie Stewart or whoever before that. And I don't see it actually at the moment, anybody there that's going to work in the same manner. I don't see Kimi that way. Fernando, I don't see that way either. So I think it was just a very different way of going racing, which was basically to be selfish and use everything for the advantage of Michael Schumacher. There's nothing wrong with that, and I think that's just a very different way of doing it. I've always been a driver that if I've got a teammate, then it's we have the same equipment and we're, you know, this guy and have a proper battle. But Michael was always, well, I'm number one, you're number two, and I'm going to have everything, you know, my way. But you can't take it away of how successful he has been.
You had two very popular wins, one on your home soil, British Grand Prix, and at Monza. And I remember watching those two races with a few of my friends, and we were all very happy for you. How was it winning your own home Grand Prix and winning at Monza, which is such a historical, magical place?
Yeah, well, the Silverstone is always special, or home Grand Prix is always special to any driver. To win the first one in your home Grand Prix just makes it that extra special, because the British fans have always been very supportive of British drivers, and to be honest, they've had in that sort of time a lot of success, because obviously they'd had Nigel winning, we'd had Damon winning, then myself, and then DC as well. So the British drivers had always done very well in, let's say, a 7-year span. So it was good for me. Mentally, it was good as well in a difficult situation, and going on to win in Monza that same year was special, again, just because of the Tifosi, Ferrari, Italy, and the history that Monza has. But the first one will always be more special just because of it being the first. But Monza was special as well, and when latterly I did it with Stewart in Nürburgring, again, it was another historic-type place to win because of the history of Nürburgring, but also it was the last race win for Jackie Stewart, which was, I think, 30 years before. And it was just, you know, made it even that more special as well, that it was that 30-year anniversary of Jackie, and then to win the race for them as well.
Now, you are one of the few drivers, at least we have access to, who have raced against both Schumacher and Ayrton Senna. Did you get to know Ayrton Senna a little bit personally, or what are your memories
a little bit
of Ayrton Senna?
Yeah, well, Ayrton was a different cookie. He was something everyone sort of looked upon Ayrton as being someone who wasn't friendly, but it was just his total focus on the job in hand to be the way it was, which he planned his press days, which latterly probably was exactly what Michael did, and you probably have to do it that way, to be honest. And I think because he did that, he gave his full physical emotion to driving a full Formula One car as quick as he could, and he always had a good teammate. He always had a battle with a teammate that was given the equal equipment, which obviously then made his job more difficult because he had to try and get the better car. But he'd also, and I know with Alain especially, that he would, if Alain was going good that weekend, he'd always try and stay behind to try and wean out a little bit of information from his engineer or whatever. But then Alain knew that, so Alain would hang around, and they'd sort of almost leave at 10 o'clock at night because they were both hanging around trying to wait for one of them to leave. And Ayrton was, you know, he was a nice guy, he was a good guy. You know, we'd have a close relationship, but we had a small relationship at races, and he was always very friendly and very, very nice to me. And I think generally he was very, very popular and very liked. He's still very popular today even. So, yeah, they were different, you know, if you're comparing him with Michael. But then you can also say Mika Häkkinen was different than Ayrton, was different than Michael. But, you know, latterly you can always say, well, Mika was someone with Ron Dennis that gave him a team, where Michael got a team, and that made it very different. But if you look at the results, you know, Mika did a very, very good job at McLaren and got that team given to him, and he achieved two world championships. But Michael did it the other way around. All right, achieved seven, but that era, you know, Mika won those two. So, all characters are different in any sport, and Formula One is no different to anything else.
You said something very interesting that caught my attention, that give them the team. In any given year throughout the history of Grand Prix racing or any series, even here in the U.S., you only have a few, three or four teams that can give you a championship-winning car, and of those four, only two of them are in a cycle where they're at the top. How important you think, since you've been in that situation, that if a good driver like a Raikkonen or Alonso gets into a good team, that the whole effort is just on him? Like, Alonso is the main man at Renault, there's no question about it. How important is that the team picks up one driver that, hey, we're going to give him every ounce of energy?
Yeah, well, it's become probably the way to be. Now, Kimi going over to Ferrari, it's going to be a little bit different, because obviously with Ross Brawn leaving, that sort of is a big, big gaping hole in Ferrari's armour. But I'm sure Jean Todt is going to try and patch that hole up. But it's going to take a lot of work to get that to be filled. Now, if that's going to take too much energy to fill, which will mean it will take too much energy out of Ferrari, I don't know. That one we're going to have to see. Kimi's not a motivating type of guy, and that's probably going to make a difference, because he's very, very quiet, doesn't really say boo to a goose. And I think that would be something, because Ferrari have had the last, 10 years almost with Michael being there or thereabouts. It's not quite 10 years, is it? No, it's close to 10 years, but it's going to be very different with that. Now, with Fernando moving across to replace Kimi, it's going to be a little bit different. The structure there isn't going to have changed so much. We haven't seen McLaren being as strong as maybe they should have been in the past couple of seasons, but you never know. The rules are changing. You know, everybody's moving, or not everybody, but McLaren are moving over from Michelin's to Bridgestone, and you never know, it could be a situation where they have Bridgestones on the car and they find a second and a half just because the car suits Bridgestone tyres. So we still have that to see at the moment. And yeah, there's going to be a tiny bit of development from other teams, but I think it's going to be really down to the guys that, one, they suit the tyres, the chassis suits the tyres. And if it's in the right car with the right driver, then obviously that's going to be the stronger team to be successful next year. But, you know, there's a long way to go in that side of it. We still haven't seen what Bridgestone can produce as far as tyres. They're going to be hard compounds, because they're not going to be given that much grip. But as I said, I think the direction as it is today, you would say, is positive for Ferrari, because they've develop the car in the way they want it to be with the tyre, and the tyre, I'm sure, will follow that route that they've got at the moment, but it will have a very different compound and be a slick tyre at the same time, so that that will make it different at the same time. But I think that's what will make it interesting next year.
Yeah, Kimi is a very interesting character. He's very quick.
But the
interesting part is that he's always going for the pole, either at the track or at the bar.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, quite a party animal.
Sorry, Ron.
Yeah. No problem. Question, how do you look at Montoya leaving Formula One and coming to NASCAR?
Yeah, well, for Juan, it was, you know, unfortunately, that Latin temperament was something that maybe sort of got in the way, and I think it was a shame, because he's got a lot of natural talent, and probably we didn't see it consistently enough, and that probably consistency was something that never shone through at McLaren. Kimi's consistent as hell, always on the ball. We did see Juan beat him a couple of times, but it was only those couple of times. And then obviously what happened in, I think, Indianapolis, which I think there was a lot going on before that, and I think that was just the iceberg won the day at the end of the day. I think the tip of the iceberg was always going on before. The iceberg won that day. Moving across to NASCAR, to be honest, I think he was always at home on high speed. He was always at home on street circuits, but also at home on an oval. And we saw what he did in his last Indy, when he won it without really a problem. And he was very much in control of the race from lap one. But NASCAR, I think, is different. But I think he'll be able to adapt no problem.
we're keeping an eye on him. We do this F1 Weekly podcast. Yeah. We're calling it the NASCAR's Monty Python show.
Giving an update. Well, it could very well be, but I hope for his sake it's probably not. But it's going to be interesting to see how that really develops at the end of it as he sort of moves up into the, I don't know, into the proper NASCAR.
One very important question. I'm sure you followed motor racing long before you got into racing as a driver. Okay, since that time, if you were a team owner and all the racing drivers you have followed as a childhood hero and ones you raced against and today, if you were a team owner and you had to pick two drivers
From history, from
the time you have followed or you have seen race, who would those two be and why?
Yeah, well, I think Jim Clark would be one for sure because I think he always stood out above the others. You know, he was in a very good era with Jackie Stewart, Graham Hill, for example, Joachim Rindt, another one. And he always seemed to be a gentleman, which in those days I think that was the way racing was. But I think that natural talent he had was very special. And unfortunately, we didn't see the full potential of what could have happened in future years. So I think he would be definitely one. And the guy that I always liked, who gave it his all, it seemed to be if he had four wheels on the car or even three, and he was in a good car or a bad car, it really didn't matter. We saw some stunning races from him, some wonderful race wins. We never sadly saw a world championship from him, but was Gilles Villeneuve, because I think he was the ultimate driver in any situation, and I think it was something that was you know, special and very rare to see. And I think it's something that we haven't seen really since then. I'd probably say the closest we've seen since then is probably Juan, in a way, because yeah. Juan has got that type of determination to just drag the car around the track. But, yeah, I think those two would be mine.
Among the new drivers here, young coming, like Nico Rosberg, Robert yeah. Kubica, Lewis Hamilton,
yeah.
Who else am I missing here? Sebastian Vettel. Who do you think has the most talent, and who do you see going very far?
Well, I think Kubica has been very special in what he's done in probably a very limited program. Kimi, I would still class him as a young one because he hasn't achieved as much as he maybe should have done. So I think Kimi's still going to be there because he's relatively young anyway. And the guy that's done very well from the younger categories has probably been Piquet. I think he did a very good job in his first test at Silverstone. I think they did. I think it was 3 days, and I think he was quickest. I think on all 3 days, where Lewis had been his first run in a Formula One car, and he beat his teammate De La Rosa by about a tenth of a second, which probably didn't. But it wasn't as impressive as I think what Piquet Jr. did. So I think that'll be interesting how that goes. He's going to be the test driver next year with Renault. Piquet Jr. And Lewis, I don't know. I read something before I came here, which I sort of found it funny as a comment, which was, I think they weren't sure if he was going to go to Brazil. I think it was decided he wasn't going to go to Brazil. And sort of Lewis sort of said, well, I don't feel I've got the experience yet, and I haven't got the proper feeling of the car, and maybe it's a good thing that I'm not going and stuff like that. But I thought that was a bit strange, because if you're a young driver, you want to get in the car as quick as you can and be on the track. And I know the testing hasn't gone, I wouldn't say smoothly for him, but he hasn't gone in there and been dominating the teammate who's been at that test. I found it a strange comment to make. And I know, you know, you've, unfortunately in this day and age, you've got to get in the car and do the job, and you've got to do it straight away.
Yeah.
And that hasn't happened yet for Lewis. Now, I don't know all the situation of what fuel he's been running or what he's been doing, but if you are a young driver trying to impress people, you need to be in a position to say, right, well, come on, right, I want low fuel and give me a go. I'm sure that's what Piquet Jr. did, I would have thought. You know, they're going to give him a run like that. I don't know. We're going to have to watch that and see what actually happens.
Talking of Piquet, I was a huge fan of his father, and he was quite a character. How do you remember Nelson Piquet?
Well, my test I did, unfortunately it was a week before the accident I had at Brands Hatch, but it was for Lotus in Monza, and that was when Nelson was there with Nakajima, and Lotus asked me to do the test, because in those days I was sort of the young gun coming through and everybody wanted me. I don't know what happened to all that one, but that was the time. There was a time when that was the way.
I remember
those days. I remember, so do I. It was a while ago, sadly, but there you go. And I turned up, And I think Nakajima was testing the car. Yeah, I think Nakajima was in the car. And I was just, after the test had finished, I was just wandering around the car. And Nelson had just turned up, and he was at the back, on the back wing. And as I was sort of walking around to the car, I hadn't met him before. And as I walked around the back of the car, in typical Nelson fashion, he just sort of stood out and sort of said, "Who are you?" So I, be me and me, I sort of went, "And who are you?" So I got him back, and he was still a big character to this day. And that was what was nice about Nelson. He could jump in the car, have some fun, but also switch off and be a damn quick Formula One driver at the same time. You know, to be 3 times world champion takes a lot of guts and determination, but he was fun with it at the same time. So, you know, there were little things where he always said about Ayrton was gay, and he went on and on, but that was his mental game, and that was, you know, he was probably an early one of the mental side of it. But as a driver, you've no, you know, you can't take away what he achieved, but in a fun way.
You know, we were talking to Christian Fittipaldi a few months ago, and of course he knows PK Jr. Sr. So I asked him, is Jr. as crazy as Sr.? He started laughing. He says, "No, he's normal."
He's definitely much more normal. I'm surprised. Nelson hasn't led him around, I think it's a different day and age as well. I think, you know, the way Nelson Jr. has been brought up is to be professional, and it is very professional. It's very different. You can't almost speak the mind that you used to be able to do. You know, you've just got to be a very, very corporate driver nowadays, and sadly that is the way it is, but that's the way it is.
You know what he did with Barrichello when he was still with Ferrari, and Nelson Piquet found out he had signed for Honda. He tells the press, and he tells them, "Oh, I still have contacts at Honda, and you can take it to the bank. It's done deal." That's Nelson Piquet for you.
Yeah. Good old Nelson, yeah.
In the championship, who are you rooting for, Alonso or Michael?
Well, I've always got one of these things that there are certain things Michael's done this year, Monaco being probably the major one, and it's just silly things like that just tarnish it, and it's sort of, you know, you know he doesn't need to do it. Or everybody knows he doesn't need to do it, but then when he does do it, it just ruins it. And all everything that went on with that mass damper thing that we had with Renault, and ever since they took that off the car, they haven't been as competitive as they were before. And I think that was something that they ran the thing, and then it was taken off, and it was like, well, why was you allowed to run it in the first place? But anyway, that was that. And then obviously, as things went down the line, Michael was edging back, which was fantastic for Formula One anyway. And then when Fernando had his engine failure in Monza, it was like a big blow to obviously Fernando and everything else. And then as things go, strange things happen, and it sort of went the other way with Michael in Japan. So it's quite strange how those things come back. And I think what's I would like to see, I'd like to see two things. And then sadly, I'm not going to see one of them. And one of them would be, yes, it'd be fantastic to see Michael do an eighth and retire as world champion, which I think is fantastic. If he doesn't win it, then he's still winning at the top. He's retiring at the top, finishing second. But Fernando, I'd like to win as well, because I think it's been a damn difficult season. It's been a couple of things that haven't gone his way, the mass damper being one of those. The engine failure, okay, now that's sort of one all, so that's okay. And then we saw what happened in Monaco, which was to try and ruin it for him. Michael got the penalty. Everyone saw that from the FIA, and that was decided. He went and started at the back of the grid, did a storming drive. But I think I'd like to see Fernando, yes. I'd like Fernando win it.
Thanks for talking to F1 Weekly. We really appreciate it, Johnny.
No problem. I'm tired.
Thank you so much for your time.
Did you know that in 1970, Sir Jack Brabham of Australia led the Monaco Grand Prix going into the final lap? But Austrian driver Jochen Rindt was the winner. What happened? And did you know Sir Stirling Moss won the final race of the 1958 season, but still missed out on becoming the first Englishman to win the world title? In that same year, what supporting role did American Phil Hill play in the Casablanca race to Moss's misery? To get the answers to these Formula One questions, order a copy of the Dynamic Duels 2007 calendar now. Please visit the merchandise page at www.f1weekly.com to own your piece of F1 history.
And here's your F1weekly.com trivia answer. Juan Manuel Fangio earned four consecutive championship crowns from 1954 to 57. The Argentinian further made this spectacle special by doing it with three different teams in four different stints: Maserati Mercedes in 54, Mercedes-Benz in 55, Lancia and Ferrari in 1956, and back with Maserati in 1957. Incidentally, his first title was back in 51 with yet another team, Alfa Romeo. So there's your trivia answer.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Thanks, Will, for another great trivia question. Keep up the good work. And for everyone, go to mytriviapodcast.com. He's got lots of good stuff out there. Okay, now, Steve Fall, my co-host, is definitely out today. And while he's prancing in Florida, we're going to share the email burden with Nasser. Nasser's in the studio, so we're going to let him start off with email number one, and we'll sort of play tag.
I don't know if I can fill Steve's shoes, but I'll make my best effort, you know. Yahoo Ads.
Excellent. That was
you know you want to. Okay, this first email, Clark, is from one of your fellow citizens of the world, Señor Ernesto Ruiz. Hey, Clark, don't be ashamed of being a citizen of the world. Only narrow-minded characters would be annoyed by correct pronouncing foreign nationals' names. Keep doing the way you've been doing. You do great. Congratulations again. Ernesto Ruiz, Lima, Peru. P.S. Rubinho is pronounced with, you know, whatever the Spanish
the
thing
is. The little frou-frou on
Rubinho, the, yeah, they have the same thing in
German. I've been practicing. Mouse.
Yeah, good. So remember Spain? I guess he's referring to Hispania.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Ernesto, thank you for listening. And we'll be very interested in hearing about the racing scene in Peru, if there are some racing tracks or what's going on in Lima and surrounding areas regarding motor racing. You have a message for Mr. Ruiz?
Keep in touch, and I've been practicing. Let me try it. Rubinho! Pretty good, huh? Okay, my turn. This is from Martin Caton in Canada, Ontario. I want to add a counterpoint to the linguistics issue. The way you guys speak and pronounce drivers' names adds color and uniqueness to your presentation. Some highlights for me are the way Clark says, Rubino, and bravo, bravo, bravo. They always make me smile. Don't change a thing. It creates energy and projects the fun and enjoyment you get out of doing the show. Thank you. Thank you very much. And we've been balancing this out, and I think I'm going to stick with my style. So thanks for the email, Martin. Keep up the good work. And don't forget, Caton Designs are the people that did our logo. So if you need anything, I believe it's CatonDesigns.com. Nass, what's the next email?
Well, I have to agree. You have to be, you know, who you are. So if you want to like to roll your R's or slip away your X or whatever you do with your, you know, agenda, I think stick to it.
Yeah, thanks, Nass.
I think everybody loves you.
Thank you, Nass. Not everybody.
Well, you know, there are always exceptions.
That's true.
But at least everybody in this room. Anyhow, moving forward, we have an email from Mr. Bruce Rhodes in beautiful Melbourne, home of the first Grand Prix of next season.
There you go.
And he writes, I have recently purchased an MP3 player and came across your site when looking for F1 podcast. I must give my congratulations to you for your enthusiasm, knowledge, and insights. Too often, F1 commentary and discussion makes the basic assumption that people are tuning in for the first time and have to be told the most basic of information. Very frustrating for most motorsport enthusiasts. Your efforts are commendable, as it appears you understand only enthusiasts will be downloading and that they are interested in the detail and behind the scene commentary, I would imagine. And also in an entertaining manner. Keep up the good work and I will keep downloading. Thanks and best wishes. Bruce Rhodes, Melbourne, Land Down Under, Australia. Thank you, Bruce.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Bruce. We're glad that you found the show, and we appreciate your support.
You know, I note with interest something that he wrote here that, you know, people assume that they have to repeat the basic thing, like Michael Schumacher is from Germany. And, you know, that is the single most frustrating thing that I experience when I watch motor racing on American TV. And when I say motor racing, I'm not talking about Le NASCAR. I mean, if you have you ever watched Indy 500 or when CBS or ABC does the coverage, you know, 10-hour tape delay. It's just like basic, you know, German driver Michael Schumacher who's driving for the Italian Ferrari team.
Yeah,
it's just like, you know, please.
The Italian Ferrari team.
Why don't you go to a baseball park and have a hot dog and let me watch the race on some other channel, you know?
Exactly, exactly. So you feel Bruce's pain.
Yes.
Excellent. Okay, I have a email from Toby James. Doesn't say where he's from, but I'll figure it out somehow. Clark, while I'm sure Michael Schumacher and Ferrari didn't appreciate the timing, karma caught up with them in Brazil, just in time to rain on his retirement parade. I think it is just desserts for the shameful incidents Michael and Ferrari have pulled off over the years. And while I know Ferrari and Schumacher fans will get over it eventually, for those such as myself, who've long been angered by the FIA favoritism of Ferrari and Michael, this is a karmatic moment that we will remember forever. Bravo, bravo, bravo. P.S. I've watched the Q3 lap of Michael again and again on TiVo with John Lennon's Instant Karma playing in the background. A fitting soundtrack to the event. Thank you, Toby. I'm glad you relished in that moment. There's a little bit out there for everybody. And thanks for the email. And keep listening to F1Weekly.com. We're going to keep it up. Okay, here's another email. Per your query on the frequency of podcasts in the off-season, this is from Ross. My vote is twice a week. Though I understand this is a significant time commitment for you and all, I have been preparing myself for the off-season and the F1 Weekly withdrawal symptoms. Your accent, pronunciation, don't change a thing. I think it is fantastico. But hey, I'm an Australian, so who am I to talk about accents? I have tried a number of alternative podcasts, and yours leaves them dead with a mixture of serious information and fun. The new forum functionality is also great and much better than the old one. Anyway, keep up the good work. Sorry, couldn't resist. Regards, Ross. He's Koala on the forum. Keep up the good work, Ross. Appreciate it. Enjoy that wonderful Australian summer. Here we go. This is from Buscabuyas. Though this is my first email, I must say that I enjoyed your podcast most of the season. As long as there are new twice a week, that would be working for me. So people like twice a week, every 2 weeks. Here's another email from Randy. Don't Americanize your pronunciations. I love to hear the correct European pronunciations. We aren't all rednecks. I mean, I may look like it, but I don't have some learning. Oh, I do have some learning. Excuse me. F1 is European, and you add the European flavor to all your podcasts. Don't cave in, Clark. Thanks for the best racing podcast on the face of the internet. And last but not least, hey, F1 Weekly, I love your show and listen to every podcast, even going back to listening to many of the shows I missed before I found you on iTunes. Keep up the good work. I just wanted to say, after listening to your last show, after the Brazilian Grand Prix, that this race almost couldn't have been scripted better for everyone. Considering all the possible outcomes and all the different ways it could have gone, think about it. Everyone got what they wanted. Philippe got a win at his home Grand Prix, proving that he is a legitimate hope for the future. Fernando winning the championship, a respectable second place, and demonstrating that he is the champion with an outstanding drive. Michael even got to look good. Winning the championship would have been simply meant that he would have won the race and Fernando did not score a point. So, it would have been somewhat of a hollow victory, but he got to prove why he is thought as the greatest F1 driver ever. He made a spectacular, thrilling drive to confirm that he is going out on top. For me, it was by far the most thrilling race of the year. Keep the podcasts coming. They're all great. My vote is for 2 podcasts a week after the season ends. If some people don't want 2, then freaking don't listen to 2. Your shows are great. More is better than less. Thanks, Dan Middleberg of Auburn, Washington. Thanks, Dan. And I think we'll probably go with two a week, depending on the holidays. Sometimes, you know, we have some personal, and I think Nasser wants to chime in on this.
Well, you know, looks like, you know, you have to give people what they want, and it looks like two is what they're looking for. So maybe we can do something like one on more current affairs and all the news that are coming. You know, most of it is rumor mill anyway. And then the other we can do is more of a historical. We'll be doing more interviews, sort of throwback on the season and stuff like that.
Exactly. That's excellent ideas. And we do have a lot of interviews in the can that we'll be putting out there. You're going to love this stuff. Just great stuff that we still haven't had a chance to put out.
And you might want to mention some of the names, you know, that we are putting on. Alan Sir Sr. is there, Johnny Rutherford, Francois Castaigne.
Francois Castaigne. I can't wait for this interview to come out because this is the pièce de résistance.
This is, say that again, please.
The pièce de résistance.
Whatever that means. He's a gentleman who brought Renault into Formula One racing back in the 70s with a turbocharged engine. So it was just a fantastic conversation with him.
We even have super attractive drivers like Milka Duno.
Absolutely.
Huh. From Venezuela?
Yeah, absolutely.
Fantastic racing heritage?
Yeah.
Whew, great stuff.
Eddie Cheever?
Eddie Cheever, yes. We have Eddie Cheever in the can. We have some good stuff. Yeah. I mean, I can't even remember all of them.
Yeah, and you know, what I'd really liked about it, talking to Eddie Cheever, even though we had, you know, brief time with him, is when we asked him and his response to how was the cultural difference driving for a French team, British team, Italian team, and the answer was so predictable.
It was,
talk about stereotyping.
Yes, but it's another great interview.
Absolutely.
We have some really, really good stuff out there. So stay tuned. The off-season will present you with some great interview. And NASA is going to be providing us with some great historical segments. We have, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, NASA, but we have Gilles Villeneuve coming up very, very soon.
You are never wrong, Clark.
Gilles Villeneuve is Nasser.
Gilles Villeneuve is coming up next month. I'm working on a story on him, and it should be interesting.
Fascinating.
One of my favorites and one of those drivers who have left a very lasting, everlasting impression. You know, more people, you know, here we are talking about him. More people talk about him still, even in magazines, than they talk about Alan Jones or Jody Scheckter. And these are guys who won world championships.
And a genuinely nice guy.
Oh, absolutely. No question about it.
On top of that. So there you have it. We're not going to let any of our listeners down. We're going to keep you guys on the edge of your seat when it comes to Formula One and motorsports history. Good night from F1Weekly.com.
This is Desiree for F1Weekly.com, thanking you, the subscribers and members of our listening audience, for listening to our podcast, reporting and commenting on Formula One, the highest echelon of motorsport, a blend of technology, tradition, glamour, and guts, all wrapped up in a high-speed package. That's F1Weekly.com for all your Formula One needs.
So come close, don't let go.